Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Quote, despite wide variance in local conditions, nearly every 1968 movement was a decolonizing one, occurring in post-colonial states of all sorts. Unquote. So writes my guest, Burley Hendrickson. He revisits the transnational activism of 1968 across the former French Empire to argue that we need to understand 1968 as part of the ongoing and unfinished history of decolonization. Today, wherever else you might be, we are taking you to three fabulous cities, Tunis, Dakar, and Paris. Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Elisa Prosperetti, and today we're speaking with Burley Hendrickson, assistant professor of French and Francophone Studies at Penn State, and author of Decolonizing 1968, Transnational Student Activism in Tunis, Paris, and Dakar. The book has just been published by Cornell University Press. Burley, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me on today. I'm really looking forward to speaking with your audience about my new book.
Yeah, it's very exciting. So introduce yourself a little bit to us. How did you come to this project?
There's probably a short, middle, and long answer to this. Hopefully I'll get somewhere in the middle of that. I would say I'd always had an interest in sort of radical politics and revolution. And I was also the child of parents who were university students during the Vietnam War, parents in the U.S. university system. So they were sort of witnessing and observing a lot of the student activism going on around them. So I think I just always grew up with sort of in that first generation that really started questioning government, hearing the conversations in at our dinner tables, and also trying to understand what it is that gets people into the streets to try to make change in their world. And then with the French Revolution, I ended up, you know, as more of an intellectual later on, I wrote a master's thesis on that. And as I was trying to think about a project for a potential, you know, dissertation topic, I started to get really intimidated about the French Revolution. And I also wanted to I was also developing interest beyond France's borders. So as I was reading about African intellectuals, the history of the former French colonies, I ended up taking a seminar in 1968 and realizing there might have been a little bit more room in that historiography where I could potentially slot myself. So it was kind of during that seminar that I started reading about France's May 68 a little bit more and stumbled on similar activism and university-wide strikes and protests in Tunisia and Senegal as well. And I started thinking about the French colonial past and figured there must be some kinds of connections I'd like to explore more.
Yeah, and we're going to talk a little bit later about that process of wrangling three places that might seem quite separated and part of separate historiographies and kind of getting them into conversation with each other. But one thing that you've just outlined is that you were drawn to this history as a history of activism, and you've presented it here as a history of transnational activism. And I think that what's interesting is that this book comes out now when it does, when it seems that this is a moment where global protests and activist movements have really found a resurgence, particularly on the left. I'm thinking of the US, but I'm also thinking right now as we're recording of protests in China against no COVID policies, the protests in Iran. There's really a global moment in which protest is somehow newly relevant in a way that I remember when I was growing up, I remember hearing people of your parents' generation saying how protests had died, you know, with the end of the Cold War. And so this book, I think, really speaks to this political moment, this broad geopolitical moment that we're in. And in the prologue of the book, I suppose, you talk about how when you first arrived in Tunisia in February of 2011 to do research, you arrived just weeks after the Arab Spring, what we now call the Arab Spring, had broken out in Tunisia. And that's something I think historians aren't always as aware about, how the present shapes the work that they're doing. So can you talk a little bit about the impact of the Arab Spring in your research, and also how that shaped your thinking about the project as you were developing it?
Yeah, certainly. Well, first off, I didn't know if I would be able to do the research because I was slated, I ended up getting lucky to get some grant funding to actually carry out this transnational research, as I had realized all of a sudden that within a 3-month period, there were these, you know, universities shutting down in all three sites that all had this sort of connection of being former French colonies. And I had purchased tickets and then was, you know, I'd been reading up on Tunisia and Senegal in the news to see what was going on before in preparation for my research trips, and saw that there was this major revolution, obviously. So it wasn't clear if it would be safe enough for one to go. And I was just in touch regularly with the American Research Overseas Center there, KORC. My good colleague, Tom DeGeorge, was director at the time and assuaged me that things were a little bit in transition, a little dicey, but that it would be okay to come. And in fact, I think it was one of the possibly best moments I could have been there to actually do this research for a number of reasons. For one, I spoke with other scholars who'd been working there, who had experienced on occasion some challenges getting access to certain archives, getting research clearances under Ben Ali's dictatorship. All of that went away. There was no oversight from the government in the research that I was doing. There was also, I think, probably most importantly, was that, you know, under the Bourguiba regime, previously before Ben Ali came to power, there was Habib Bourguiba was dictator from basically 1957 to 1987. And, you know, so during the time that I was trying to understand these 68 movements, and a lot of folks had been very scared to discuss politics, especially with a foreigner, fear of surveillance. Again, all this went away. And the folks that I spoke to, the former 68ers, and even just Tunisians that I would meet at the cafes and talk about the current situation, they had like a desire to engage in politics, political discussions, to discuss a future where democracy might be possible, to live without fear, and to envision a new future. So I think, you know, perhaps the most important impact that the revolution had for my research was just making it possible and opening those doors to have those conversations safely and freely. But it also, it was really hard not to make comparisons between, I mean, I was looking at like images of Bouazizi, the young 26-year-old Tunisian who self-immolated because he was in such dire straits economically and depressed and under Ben Ali. Just his visual image, you know, who ends up becoming the face of the Arab Spring and this martyr for Tunisians. He looked strikingly similar to Mohamed Benjennet, who was scapegoated for leading protests in June of 1967 for a pro-two-state solution stance, a Tunisian leftist at the theology school who didn't like Bourguiba's close relationship with the West. So just seeing this kind of resonance that there was some historical continuities between these two actors, both seeking change, both experiencing government repression, both being taken up as causes by young folks in Tunisia, and both being seen as sort of symbols of a youth movement for change. So yeah, definitely had a major impact on the research and the ways that I was thinking about it.
Well, let's pick up with Ben Jennett, because I think that's a good segue into talking just briefly about each of these three cases that you're looking at. Again, Tunis, Paris, and Dakar in 1968. And the first chronologically is Tunis in March of 1968. And you just explained how the protest kind of began because of the scapegoating of Ben Jennett. But what I found really helpful in thinking about 1968 in the way it conjugates in Tunisia is that this is really a protest that comes out against the Six-Day War the year prior. And so you have clearly a kind of global or transnational political context, but of course there's also the very local context of the student demands and student grievances. So maybe talk us through each of those three cases.
Sure. Right. So Ben Jennett ends up getting scapegoated for sort of leading, you know, hundreds of activists who were upset with Bourguiba's position. And it ended up not so dissimilar to the French case, where you had a sort of initial student grievance. And really what sets off larger numbers of protesters is the government response. When you had, you know, one student just for showing up outside of an embassy getting 20 years of hard labor, that set off thousands of students at the University of Tunis who shut down the university, demanded their release of detained activists from the 67 protest. And it was actually the pronouncement of those guilty verdicts that led to those initial protests. So it ended up sort of shifting from a kind of general anti-colonial stance, viewing sort of Israel as a colonial aggressor, and viewing negatively those Tunisian existing ties with France and Britain and the U.S. And it turned quite quickly into something about more basic human rights, penal reform. There were other students over the course of the March 68 protests who were swept up and detained, who never had access to an attorney, never had any proper legal defense, unconstitutionally detained, not able to speak to their parents who didn't know their whereabouts. And some of them spent almost a decade rotting in torture chambers under the Bourguiba administration. So somewhat paradoxically, a number of Tunisian advocates based in France, largely in Paris, launched some international human rights campaigns for the release of these political dissidents and student protesters and activists. So they later were able to collaborate with associations of international lawyers based in France. They worked with other French professors who were signing on to petitions in support of these students, trying to gather public opinions, reaching out to media and the press to put international public pressure on Bourguiba to release these folks, and in some instances had some success. So in many ways, this is sort of, we can see this shift from kind of general anti-colonialism to something much more concrete for rights at the local level, but launched from abroad.
Great quote from Foucault, who says, it wasn't the May 1968 in Paris that made me, it was the Tunisia 1968 that made me. And I think that that is just really helpful to kind of align our understandings of how this year, you know, happened and its importance in the Tunisian case.
Exactly. There were a couple of transnational actors. There were several, but a few of note that I think your listeners might have more access to. And, you know, Foucault was, you know, widely criticized across France for having little to no presence in the 68 movement, unlike Southwell, who was often at the front lines. And when in fact he wasn't present, he was actually a visiting professor in the philosophy department at the University of Tunis from 1966 to 68, and had in his classrooms some of these student activists who were later imprisoned and detained. So he, you know, he wrote, he took deposition testimony on their behalf, trying to release them. There was one, Ahmed Ben Othmani, who features fairly prominently in the book, was a former student of his. And after the June 67 protests, Foucault actually allowed him to hide out in his Sidi Bou Said apartment to evade police. Eventually, he was captured and brought in, and was one of the folks who experienced horrible, horrible tortures for most of the 1960s and early 1970s. But in any event, Foucault certainly, what I found interesting later, you know, claiming that he sort of became politically engaged after what he witnessed. He was also finishing up Discipline and Punish at this time. And I, to my mind, I'm not a Foucault specialist, but there's no way that this wasn't impacting his interpretations of how an oppressive government works, how an oppressive penal system can sort of control and discipline an entire society. And that sort of reading Othmani's testimonies and memorials about his experiences and the interactions he had with the perpetrators of these crimes, you can see that sort of diffusion of power that Foucault kind of brings out and became, I think, sensitized to after he witnessed what was going on there. Also, Alain Geismar, who some of your listeners may know as he's a prominent student activist against the Algerian War in the early 1960s and later was head of SNESUP, a major national teachers union, was beckoned by French teachers who were working as coopérants, working in a program teaching in Tunisian universities and high schools, who requested him to come and advise them on what kind of role they could take in perhaps helping the student movement. As coopérants, part of their, it was stipulated that they weren't supposed to engage in any sort of support. They didn't have the right to strike and join a student movement in the same way that they would in France because of their status in Tunisia. And Geismar became aware of the movement as he went and you know, took a plane right in 1968 and visited with these folks to advise on them. And then later was at the front lines in May with French students. So the other thing I find interesting about this was that Bourguiba and Senghor as well were trying to delegitimize the student movements taking place on their campuses, flagship university campuses, and basically trying to claim that their students were just imitating the French and what had happened in May 68. But that's that's totally impossible with the Tunisian case, since it started in March a couple months earlier. And in the case of Senegal, it had a very local context that had set it off. There was there's very little evidence at all that these were just imitations or that they were following orders from abroad, from their, you know, previous colonial oppressors like Senghor and Bourguiba were trying to claim.
Well, I mean, that's, I think, the fundamental dimension about this book and about your work on 1968 and its consequences, which is really stepping back from each of these cases and seeing them not connected in the sense that A led to B led to C, right? But seeing them as connected in the sense that you have these actors circulating. So Maghrebi and Senegalese students in Paris, French coopérants, and we should say coopérants were engaged by the French state as kind of development workers, technical assistants in former French colonies and dependencies. So you have these kind of transnational circulations, but you also have these broad transversal geopolitical protests and alignments in the context of the Cold War. So whether it's Palestine, whether it's the Vietnam War, whether it's the Algerian War, that really cleave, you know, internally countries in this political moment, but also bind transnationally the left in this moment, which is what you're tracing. So tell us about what happens in Paris in 1968, which is a couple weeks after what happens in Tunis.
Yeah, so I mean, it depends on what there's a large debate among scholars of the sort of origin story of Francis May 68. And I'd have to give a shout out here to Michel Zancarini Fournel, who was a preeminent scholar of 68, who was one of the first to sort of call it the 68 years and try to just get us out of this tiny little snapshot that historians had been sort of obsessed with. That also, I mean, the idea that it's just May of 68. Is sort of telling. So kind of writing against this idea, that periodization was often categorized by, you know, some of the first major clashes with French police in the Latin Quarter took place right around May 1. And on then on like May 30 or 31, de Gaulle gives this famous speech, basically saying, you know, calling out the students and saying, okay, French, you know, what do we want here? Do you want me or do you want these sort of hapless students, and that sort of being the sort of death knell of the movement, that later in this referendum, the French people come out and in droves, and de Gaulle wins, you know, relatively easily against socialist and communist adversaries, and many sort of thinking that everything's done. And there were also some accords going on between major worker unions and the French state around that time. So there's been, historians have kind of been pushing back on that notion. But for me, at least for the heightened activism that took place and the heightened clashes between the state and student populations, for me, it's the March 22 movement, which was led by Daniel Cohn-Bendit, to liberate students who'd been detained for ransacking and vandalizing an American Express store in the heart of Paris as a symbol to sort of reject U.S. presence in Vietnam and U.S. global capitalism. So, of course, this is illegal activity. Some of these, they were from the communist youth movement group, the GCR in France. So Xavier Longlade was detained, imprisoned, and they wanted his release. And they were, this was all kind of in the context of anti-Vietnam War movement. At the same time that the University of Nanterre, this is in the outskirts of Paris, was battling with what they viewed as sort of paternalism from the French state and university authorities, separating male and female dorms, making access to libraries challenging. So there was more at issue here, but really that March 22 movement was sort of really picking up steam around this anti-Vietnam War cause, but generally against all sorts of forms of authoritarianism and paternalism that they saw, you know, in the home, in the dorms, in the classrooms, and rejecting global capitalism in the face of the United States. These clashes sort of picked up, and there was this famous Night of the Barricades in the night of May 10, 11. And this is when, you know, Parisians are looking out their windows and watching cops smash up and bash unarmed students. And it also had resonances with, you know, the commune and revolutionary groups taking over the city, and they literally took up all the bricks and piled them all up and blocked off the streets and flipped cars and were battling it out with the own with their own state for control over that city center, that Latin Quarter that was a heart of the major universities in Paris.
So that is Paris 1968, and you know, it's easy to understand why that's been somehow the banner 1968. Of course, we have not just, you know, North Africa and West Africa. We have Mexico, we have Czechoslovakia. So there's a bigger canvas here, which we're aware of. But I think in the space of the Francophonie or former French Empire, Paris really sucks up the oxygen. So, and then you have our third 1968 in your book, which is what happens in Dakar just a few weeks after.
Yeah. So, and one of the thing, as I sort of shift gears and talk about Dakar, that is worth mentioning is that, you know, France is sort of a drowning empire at this moment. They've just lost Vietnam, in 54 with Jian Benfu. They've been replaced by the United States. So that's on the minds of these sort of French activists and anti-colonialists. They've also recently just lost their sort of crown jewel in Algeria in 1962. So some of those images I described of, you know, riot police in the streets duking it out with students, there was a very short memory with or close linking memories with what was taking place with anti-Algerian war activism. I mean, one of the reasons that the French were unsuccessful was that public opinion shifted and no longer supported that that bloody and gruesome war in Algeria up until 1962. So there was a real resonance with what they were witnessing and the very recent colonial losses. So just in terms of, you know, how decolonization is factoring into this Parisian case, it wasn't just disgruntled students throwing bricks. There was also this kind of national history at work as well, national history and memory. In the case of Dakar, this, like the sort of local unique cases would be the government was kind of running out of money. They had a really poor groundnut and peanut harvest the preceding year, and they had been investing really heavily, almost a third of their budget in national education. So they decided they were going to cut back on student scholarships. And I know you've done some work on this in the Ivory Coast, which I think was perhaps taking some notes on the Senegalese case and not wanting to do the same thing to avoid the sort of troubles that were to come. But students had been trying to negotiate with the government as soon as they learned of this in the spring of 68, and the government refused to sit down with them and were going through with the budget cuts. So students at the end of May, just a few weeks after the French had really clashed in the streets, shut down the university campus and had a university-wide strike. And what was interesting about the Senegalese case here, they were the flagship university in West Africa. So in terms of student breakdown, about one third of the population was actually Senegalese nationals. One third were French nationals, and one third were a variety of neighboring African countries. So most of the striking students, the French had almost no part in this. There were French who supported the movement, but those were all from abroad, like activists who were engaged, like Kone Bondit that I'd mentioned earlier, had Senegalese friends in Paris that were informing of the situation there. They were creating transnational movements of solidarity with them, but the French actually on the campus didn't join. However, Senegalese and other neighboring African students of neighboring nations did join forces, and Senghor was really the Senegalese president was livid, furious. Someone who had himself benefited so much from a French education system, basically put a very similar one in place in Dakar, and students began to not just protest the fact that they were going to lose out on some scholarship money, but they also were protesting about the content of the curriculum. You know, why are we the flagship West African university and we study more French poets than African ones? Why are we still studying, you know, Rousseau and Baudelaire? Why aren't we studying our own people? So it was also about decolonizing that curriculum and about decolonizing industry in Senegal, which was still heavily influenced by French nationals and folks from the Levant, from Syria and Lebanon. So they wanted to kind of nationalize and Africanize the university, industry. They wanted to get away from only, you know, having this overdependence on agriculture that they were exporting to back to France instead of serving the local population and diversifying that in case they had a poor crop that year. So there was a lot at play in Senegal. And in fact, the Tunisian case, workers never joined them. They were in 68, they were kind of in line step with the Bourguiba regime and the single party state. But really powerful national labor unions in Senegal and France both ended up sort of piggybacking onto these student movements and taking them well beyond the university campuses and having great success in advocating for their own worker rights.
So we've looked at these three cases, and we see that they're a mix of kind of very local conditions, context struggles, And also this broader fabric, this broader landscape, you know, that of this moment. And I wanted to turn to the title of the book, Decolonizing 1968. Very short, but once I read your introduction, I find out that these two words really mean a great deal. And I think in my shorthand, what I understand as your overriding argument was that these were struggles that were created by, and that were anti-colonial struggles. So in some sense, they were wrestling with problematics left over or unfinished from colonialism. But at the same time, the fact of having been connected through the imperial structures created the possibilities for these transnational activisms, for these exchanges, for these circulations. And so it's really difficult to disentangle these 1968s from the fact of empire and its unfinished business as the, or unfinished independence as the Senegalese say. So how do you think about the title and the work that it's doing and the arguments that it's encapsulating? Because for two words, it really does a lot of work.
Yes. Well, thank you for that. I think you laid that out a little better in some ways than I could, but I think I have to thank one of my blind peer reviewers who edited the manuscript in just sort of allowing me the possibility to just sit in the uncomfortable tension that decolonization produces and that this moment produces. And I think that's exactly it. I was sort of fighting against this. When I started the project, I wanted to so decenter France and Paris that I was going to try to look at Lyon as another case study. But after I got into the sources, it's just like Paris was just always there. I don't know if it's the centerpiece, but it's clearly a hugely important piece in connecting these three movements. And relaying information between activists underground to sort of push back against state control. So, I mean, I think there's a lot at work. I think part of the decolonizing was realizing just how much decolonization generally, literally, was informing these movements. You know, I viewed 68 for the Tunisian and Senegalese case in some ways as sort of the litmus test of how decolonized are we, and students saying not decolonized enough. We need to expedite this process. And, you know, you sort of mentioned at one point, you know, the university is kind of where a lot of this is taking place, or at least where it starts. And that was also a sort of holdover, a legacy or fragment of French Empire, you know, put in place to serve the French Empire. We're going to create universities and institutions abroad to coach up and train folks that we think will serve our administration. And those end up being the sort of centers of post-colonial revolt against exactly those continued neo-imperial ties. And I mean, I think this shifted from when I first started working on the project as a graduate student, where I was reading a lot of post-colonial theory that was heavily informing the types of the stories I wanted to tell. I do view it as decentering. I think Tunisian Senegal feature, you know, at least as prominently as France does in a story, and they do for me. I wanted to, you know, highlight those voices. We don't know what they were saying as much as we know about Cohn Bendit, even though they were conversing with him and knew about him and interacting with his organizations and associations. But I think for me, I started also reading as I was revising for the book, learning a lot more about decolonial studies and what our colleagues in Latin American studies had been doing the last 10 or 20 years. So I think for me, it was this sort of a combination, the arguments as they became more refined, were a combination of me getting feedback from good reviewers, for one, but also me thinking more clearly about my sources and about new theories and methods that I was kind of reading in concert. So for me, I'm sitting in the uncomfortable tension produced by this moment and by the sort of theoretical questions that are shifting, you know, as we try to write and handle these projects. So it's also about sources. under dictatorships, you don't have the same access to archives. That are fewer things are recorded or open to researchers. So you actually, at least for 68ers who are still around, you can go talk to them and get the story from the horse's mouth. Those, you know, suppressed stories about torture and detention, it can be pretty moving and powerful when you speak to someone who endured that and lived to tell it. One interviewer in particular, I think, was in some ways ashamed that he wasn't as mentally or physically strong as someone like Ahmed Ben Othmani, who spent, you know, a decade in prison and had just somehow developed this huge tolerance for pain. And this guy only lasted 3 months. And then he had to, you know, pledge allegiance to the regime and swear he'd never do it again. And then they release him and he gets to live and see his family again. But someone who's, you know, crying in an interview isn't the same kind of interview you're going to have with a French 68er who may have been near a little bit of, you know, police brutality in the streets, but not a decade of torture with no defense attorney or speaking to your parents. So that's where, while they're transnationally connected, there is a level of comparison that they're not exactly the same experience for these folks, even if they're overlapping and sharing kind of anti-colonial concerns.
The, you know, idea of decolonization is framing the possibilities of solidarity and also the kind of problematics against which solidarity is mobilized, to me, is very, very clear when you talk about why the university was a site of protest and struggle in each of these three cases. And, you know, we could think about other sites that would have, you know, that would have elicited such struggle. I was just thinking the Senegalese case, right? Railways, when you think about earlier, or the dock workers in Mombasa that Frederick Cooper writes about, you know, these were other symbols of colonialism that elicited a certain type of anti-colonialism in the 40s. But here in 1968, it's the university. How do you understand the site of the university as the place where these 1968s unfold?
Right. Well, I think one thing, and this was in large part a global phenomenon and might explain in part why 68 was, you know, goes beyond just these French cases. And we can see other iterations, some of which you mentioned earlier, Mexico, Prague, et cetera. But they were rapidly expanding. We've got these boomer generations. You have emerging independent nations, like, you know, 1960, we know, is kind of the banner year for African independence. Their top students are no longer getting subsidized by former European imperial powers to come fly them or ship them to France or Britain or wherever for studies, not to the same extent. These funds are on a decline. So these emerging nations have to create their own institutions and serve their own people. And that's very costly, but it's now under their charge. But it also gives more students access. You can only fly so many students to France from Senegal, but it's much easier to serve those populations, you know, locally at the national level. Same thing in Tunisia. So they're, you know, and they're also expanding secondary and primary and secondary education. In many cases, expanding it it's becoming mandatory. You have more women involved, girls and women involved in education, getting access to universities. So they're growing rapidly. They're having growing pains. They don't have enough room to house them. And you have, this is also, you know, with youth, often unmarried without children. You don't have the stresses of feeding the family, yet you have an intellectual engagement with the outside world. And you're putting them all in a very tight space that's exploding at the same time that you have these ongoing global anti-colonial movements taking place. I mean, it almost is like a, you know, science experiment waiting to happen on these campuses, particularly at that moment. If I don't have the figures exactly right now, but in France, it was something like from 1960 to 68, it was the university population exploded from like 200,000 to 600,000, which was something like 150 to 180% growth in the 8-year period. And that was doubled in Tunisia and Senegal. Now, the scale is smaller because those universities weren't as large as the French system, but they're certainly having a rapid period of growth.
So in the second part of the book, you know, the first part, which we've just been talking about, you really lay out these three separate cases. And in the second part of the book, you look at kind of the what these 1968s wrought in each local political context, which is quite interesting. Often we think of, you know, 1968, or maybe, you know, the long 1960s, but we don't trace it so far the way that you do throughout the 1970s here. And to just briefly summarize, in Tunis, you talk about how the student movements of 1968 help ignite a kind of human rights activism. And in Paris, you talk about how the left begins to take up immigrant workers' rights, and then immigrant workers themselves begin to mobilize for their own rights, not interested in the French left, you know, holding, quote unquote, their hand. And then in Dakar, you talk about how the 1968 movement and protest eventually helps break down the single party state that Senghor has tried to consolidate around himself and leads to democratization. So my kind of overall question is how you connect the process and the experiences and the struggles against decolonization to the rise of human rights discourse, which is something that some scholars like Samuel Moyne see as quite distinct, as not feeding in one to the other. Whereas you posit that there really are deep connections there.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's funny. I actually, you know, I learned a lot from that, the really important Moyne book. And I remember as a sort of late career grad student when that came out, also getting really, really angry with a couple of the arguments in it. And I think he's also shifted since the book came out after getting attacked at a few conferences, probably unjustly. But so he did write this really important intervention and, you know, claimed that human rights didn't really become a thing until at least the 1970s, as the term started appearing more in, you know, English titled works and newspapers and cropping out, that this obsession with 47 in the United Nations Declaration is wrong. But he has this whole chapter on a lot of these national independence movements. He looks a lot at Vietnam, as I recall, and kind of makes the claim that these movements for decolonization weren't about human rights at all, because there wasn't a universal nature to them, that they were fixated on rights at the national level and independence at the national level. And I just don't view those as mutually exclusive. So maybe it's semantics, but I really don't think that, you know, the Tunisians were advocating for human rights and the French and the Senegalese and other North Africans and members of the international community who joined their cause and assisted them, they weren't only concerned with Tunisia's human rights. They were, you know, they were laser beam focused on the folks that they knew about as individuals stuck in that authoritarian sort of quagmire of, you know, underground cave. But they would have wanted those rights, I think, for most of humanity. So for me, that's kind of maybe the pushback on the Moyne argument that I would have. And also, I think there are ways of talking about, like, I think there's a lot of overlap. I've started getting a lot more interested since this project in, you know, dignity and indignation as sources of revolutionary activity, also as sources of counter-revolutionary activity. The indignation that Bourguiba and Senghor felt at these students complaining about a government that's investing a quarter to a third of its national budget in education. They were indignant about it. They were upset about it. That's why they sent these, you know, militias and military in to vacate the campuses. But I think that human rights also I wouldn't make the overarching claim that it was the outcome of 68 in all of these cases. I think it rears its head in varying degrees, and in Tunisia, it was the most acute. In France, I think there was this heightened interest and sensitivity to the immigrant plight. This was sort of at the tail end of the glorious years, as we call it in French historiography, of like 30 years of economic growth post 45, that ends with really egregious public racism toward large, principally North African communities that were recruited to come and rebuild France, to feed this economic machine and build the cars and work in the factories. That then gets mistreated, and then you have a reason for a cause, and there was a there was this kind of fleeting obsession on the left with largely informed by Maoism, French Maoists, who instead of kind of going back to the fields, they went back to the factories and tried to recruit immigrants to take over, to radicalize them and take over factories and have the workers run them. But I think a lot of the immigrant movement became an autonomous one in the 1970s as an outgrowth of 68, where they were like, I don't think you need to hold the microphone at our meetings and organize us. We're quite capable of doing it ourselves and speaking on our own terms. So I think an outgrowth of this, you had this interest and connection where French leftists, wanted to fight the good fight, join the cause, that also ends up in some ways, initiating autonomous immigrant workers associations.
And then in the Senegalese case, it sounds from what I gathered from that chapter that it's human rights in the sense of more freedom of expression and the ability, and having a one party state let in other political voices and parties to kind of open up the civil sphere that had been closed for a decade or 15 years or so. So I think that, we've talked almost cavalierly about the fact that you've written a book in which Paris, Tunis, and Dakar are constantly in conversation with each other. And I really just want to commend you for having done that. That's so much work, so challenging to work in three different, not just geographical spaces, but historiographical spaces, and to find the connections without flattening any of the three, and letting them all speak in their own terms. And I think that's really such a marvelous contribution of this book as a model of how we can think about doing that. So as we're coming to a close here, I wanted to ask you what future project you are incubating and thinking about and working on.
Well, first off, thank you so much for that generous description of the book. I think it was, none of it would be possible without, a lot of help from local archivists and scholars having conversations with me and pointing me in certain directions. And I'd be the first to admit that I'm well aware the book has many flaws, but I think when you're doing something as challenging as this, that's hopefully it will open conversations and younger scholars can come out, or older scholars, I don't care how old they are, can point out some things that I've missed. But at least I think, the work of putting them in conversation was quite fruitful, and I'm grateful for folks in all these places that helped make it happen. So the next project, this is also probably too big for me and a little bit ambitious, but we'll see where I end up going with it. But I've started, again, I was inspired by this project and the conversations with former 68ers that I had, that especially in the case of Tunisia, that just kept bringing up dignity, dignity. They felt that their Wazizi was the symbol for them of the absence of dignity under that system, and a desire to live a dignified life, to have the right to that sort of dignified existence, and an indignation at corrupt behavior, and a sort of hope for the future. So I've started thinking also, it was a couple summers ago, I was getting ready to teach my first grad seminar, and I learned about Robin Mitchell's work, where she was Venus Noir. She makes this really interesting argument about humiliation as of France losing Haiti in the early 19th century as part of the reason that white French society exoticized to such an extent the 19th century black female bodies. And I just thought this was fascinating, this idea that imperial loss could potentially have a certain sort of consequence on French national behavior and national identity and the way that they would, you know, treat the others in their society and maybe generate new ideas about others. So the sort of loose title currently is Dignity and Indignation from the Enlightenment to the Arab Spring. And I've gone back and started looking at Kant a little bit and his sort of definitions. He wrote widely about what dignity means to him. And Spinoza wrote about indignation as a possible way for kind of multitudes of the indignant masses to rise up at certain moments. And he was a bit scared of that. But so I'm thinking about imperial loss and the indignation that certain folks feel. And I wanted to do a broad comparative study looking at how that loss of Haitian, of Saint-Domingue in France and this massive, you know, sugar colony that was in the first creation of the first Black Republic in the modern world, and compare that with other major imperial losses in the French Empire and how that may have, you know, shifted the ways that the French viewed themselves and viewed their others, and also how those others, what is that threshold where they felt their dignity has been so threatened that they might rise up and seek to change the world that they live in. So Haiti and Algeria are definitely there. And I wanted to look at, you know, again, revisit a sort of more post-colonial case in Tunisia, just based on the inspiration I had from those interviews I conducted right after the Arab Spring. So it's a bit loose and all over the place, but I'm excited about it and I'm learning a lot.
It sounds to me like indignation is very deeply implicated in the Empire Project. And so it seems to me that there's a lot there to chew on.
I mean, we mentioned in our, you know, brief informal discussion before we launched the podcast, we were kind of talking about, a rise in leftist movements globally, which I think is the case. And I think, like in 68, there's also a rise in white nationalism that's also taking place in a number of places as well. So I think that, and I think that we can see that in some of Mitchell's work, and I'm hoping to kind of build on that direction where she's pointed me and see how it might play out in other cases of imperial loss as well.
Well, thank you, Burley, for taking the time to speak with us. I think that this book, in putting together these three cities and these 1968s and their consequences, is in some ways really a reflection of empire and its dismantling, the way it was lived in these deeply connected ways that aren't separated the way that we have come to do them, to do so retroactively. So thank you very much for the book and for taking the time to speak with us, and we wish you all the best.
Thanks so much, Elisa.